Enjoyed myself at this workshop, so much so that I wanted to give a talk on something different, but I got distracted here and then different stuff didn't get done. And so apologies to people who saw this talk in Trieste. It's exactly the same talk. So this is going to be about some work I've done with Sean Carroll and Lisa Randall. And starts here. So basically, if you have extra dimensions, very simply, you get a landscape of lower dimensional vacua, because there are many different ways that you can think of to cleverly hide these extra dimensions. So a fundamental question that you can ask is, why are some dimensions small while others are large? And this is a fundamentally cosmological question. So we've also heard a lot about eternal inflation, which is typically thought to mean transitions between different vacua entirely within the context of some four-dimensional effective theory, where those vacua are thought to be coming from this fact that you can compactify dimensions in many different ways. But, well, what about those extra dimensions? Are they important? Do they just participate benignly by providing you with all of these possible different four-dimensional effective theories? Or perhaps can they play a direct dynamical role in this entire process of, say, populating a variety of four-dimensional effective theories? So today we're going to talk about some toy model where you can see very directly how the presence of extra dimensions can influence the dynamics of populating different vacua in a very direct way. We're going to do that by studying this very simple theory of Einstein gravity in d dimensions with a positive cosmological constant and some flux. So here's the punchline, and then we'll go through in detail how we get this. We're basically going to construct some non-singular frames that interpolate across event horizons between some d-dimensional de Sitter space and some lower dimensional open FRW universe, where the size of the sphere, I assume some spherical symmetry, the size of the sphere becomes a constant at late times. So here's a sketch of this geometry. So over here, we've got some d-dimensional region. That's future infinity of some d-dimensional de Sitter space. There's a cosmological event horizon, a black brain event horizon, and then inside of that brain horizon, you basically asymptote to an effectively lower dimensional space. So this geometry acts as an interpolator between regions of various dimensionality. Further, these solutions can be nucleated out of a d-dimensional de Sitter space, providing a dynamical explanation, perhaps, for, in this toy model, why some number of extra dimensions became compact in the first place. And of course, there are lots of different lower dimensional vacua, and we can see exactly how they're populated in this model. Okay, so this is related to a lot of previous work. Most relevant is this work by Giddings and Myers, where they suggest such a possibility of being able to dynamically compactify extra dimensions. Various work on black hole nucleation, brain solutions, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, but this picture can be understood almost entirely from just looking at completely vanilla black holes in four dimensions. So if I take the Schwarzschild black hole, here's the metric inside the horizon. I look in here inside the event horizon. And of course, I go from r equals 2m to r equals 0. And I can perform some change of coordinates and expand in the limit where tau goes to 0. And I get a metric that looks like this near the horizon. So you'll note that this piece looks a lot like some two-dimensional Friedman-Robson-Walker universe, where the coordinate x goes from minus infinity to infinity, and tau goes from 0 to some maximum value at the crunch. And I have a compactified two-sphere. This is a little bit of poetic license. It's compactified in the sense that it never gets bigger than 2m when I'm inside of a black hole, and it goes to 0. So it's always small. OK, but in this picture, tau equals 0 is a two-dimensional Big Bang, and it's not really a curvature singularity. It's just an event horizon. So of course, we can go outside the black hole. You just do that by analytically continuing this tau coordinate, changing r and t in the original metric. And then you can evolve away from the event horizon. And of course, that Big Bang now just turns into a region where you asymptote out to four-dimensional space outside the black hole. Okay, so we can be a little bit more explicit in this model. So we can just postulate a metric that has the symmetries we want of an FRW universe, two-dimensional FRW sections, and a sphere. And Einstein's equations tell us we have to solve these two equations, one dynamical equation for the radius of the two-sphere, and a constraints equation. And of course, this looks a lot like a particle in a one-dimensional potential, where the potential is half log r. And you can see that event horizons, I told you a goes like tau near the event horizon, so a equals 0 corresponds to an event horizon, occur where the derivative of r is 0 with respect to the variable tau. So you can basically specify a solution by telling me what the radius of the horizon is, just like I can specify a solution by telling you where what the mass is of the black hole. So then inside the horizon, we just evolve from some initial condition. R is some value, A is 0, and R prime is 0. And the field kind of rolls down this potential as you evolve to the singularity. And of course, you can continue across the horizon and do the same thing and patch together the Schwarzschild geometry. So we're reinventing the wheel. And this method is just to illustrate that by performing some kind of dimensional reduction, again, poetic license a little bit, just assuming spherical symmetry, you can construct these solutions and basically use some lower dimensional effective description to classify solutions to general relativity with some symmetries. Okay, so keeping going with this simple example, we can add some charge to the black hole. So we'll add a two-form. And then the effective potential in this formalism picks up another term. And we get a potential that looks like this, and it's got a minimum. So as you may know, there are solutions to four-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell theory where you have a two-dimensional anti-Sitter space across a two-sphere. And there's a landscape of vacua in four dimensions. So landscapes are not anything fancy. This is just saying you have numbers of different charges. So there's a quantum number that you can vary in this theory, right? And of course, we have black holes. And here's the Penrose diagram for Rice-Nordstrom black hole. And in this region between two event horizons that these geometries have, you basically get this two-dimensional FRW looking like universe where you have a Big Bang, which is the outer horizon, and a Big Crunch, which is the inner horizon. So we can be even more fancy, and we can add a cosmological constant. And now we get, for a positive cosmological constant in a certain range, an effective potential that looks like this. So there's two kinds of minima. Now we can find solutions where if I sit there, I can generate two-dimensional anti-de Sitter cross S2. And if I sit here, I could generate two-dimensional de Sitter cross S2. As you raise Q for fixed lambda, there's a critical value where those two minima merge. And actually, you can find Minkowski space, two-dimensional Minkowski space cross an S2. And that's a solution to this theory. And in this case, the black holes can have up to three horizons. So there's going to be two black hole horizons, kind of like in the charged black hole, and then there's the cosmological horizon. So this region in here, which is in between the outer black hole event horizon, this guy, and the cosmological event horizon, interpolates between some four-dimensional asymptotically de Sitter region and some two-dimensional FRW universe. Okay. So the charged black holes in de Sitter space are, in a sense, interpolating solutions between regions that have different numbers of dimensions. And because we're in de Sitter space, there's something even more interesting that can happen, which is we know de Sitter space has temperature, and so there can be fluctuations. In particular, we know that de Sitter space in four dimensions is semi-classically unstable to nucleating charged black holes. You can make a pair anti-pair. And the rate for that to happen, the probability per unit four volume, is just given by some instanton. Okay? So in the sense, and this is exactly the sense that I want to talk about in a minute, The two-dimensional region inside of this charged black hole is spontaneously nucleated, right? So there's some probability of producing this charged anti-charged pair, which creates this geometry, which has a two-dimensional de Sitter-looking region. And this is an example of what I'd like to call dynamical compactification. So of course, if you carry this picture a little bit further, globally you produce an infinite number of black holes in this de Sitter space, and each of them is going to have a slightly different charge, and therefore you're going to populate all of the various vacua that existed in this theory, all of the possible two-dimensional crunching universes that exist inside these black holes. And future infinity becomes bifurcated in a way that's exactly analogous to what happens in eternal inflation, like we've heard about before. So the question that we're going to ask now is, I showed you this toy example, and we'll do another toy example that's more interesting. What if this lower dimensional FRW was four dimensions, so it could look like our universe? And what if it didn't end in a big crunch, so it could really be a true cosmology that didn't end up being boring and crunching? Well, not necessarily boring. Maybe something interesting happens at the crunch. But now, basically, the magic of higher dimensional GR is going to allow us to do exactly this. So again, we're just going to be working with d-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell theory with a positive cosmological constant. And we're going to make an ansatz that we're looking for metrics, which has some two-dimensional spherical symmetry. And there's a four-dimensional product. Here's the sphere. And I've added these functions because it's going to be convenient in a second. So basically, this has to do with the volume of the sphere. So we're going to add some magnetic flux. And I know that if I add magnetic flux, Maxwell's equations are trivially satisfied, essentially, for this form of the Q form. And I picked magnetic flux. I could have picked electric flux, but because it's magnetic, and later I want to calculate some instantons, I don't have to deal with boundary terms and such, so it's just easier. And now what we can do is we can stuff this ansatz back into the action I had. We can integrate over the angular coordinates on the sphere. And I'm going to end up in the Einstein frame because I've appropriately defined the scalar. And I get a four-dimensional theory of gravity coupled to a scalar field, where basically I can define the four-dimensional Planck scale in terms of the d-dimensional Planck scale. It's just a proportionality of the volume of a unit Q-sphere. And if I was interested in the radius of the Q-spheres up here, this is the conversion between R and phi. OK, totally standard stuff. So the potential for this scalar field depends on what kind of sources I assume in my d-dimensional action, of course. And so there's going to be three pieces. One piece comes from the curvature of the Q-sphere. That's this term. It's negative. One piece comes from the cosmological constant, which I'm assuming is positive definite, so that's positive. And the other one comes from this magnetic flux, which is also going to be positive. So here's some plots of the potential to give you some intuition for what happens. So if lambda was 0, then I have a potential which always has a negative minimum. And as I increase q, that potential migrates to larger values of phi, and it becomes less negative. If I have lambda greater than 0, then for very small q, I get a negative minimum again. And as I increase q, it passes through 0 and becomes positive. Okay, so this theory has four-dimensional de Sitter vacua across some sphere. And so like I said, we can have these lower dimensional vacua with positive, negative, or zero vacuum energy. That's our landscape in this model. You can have four-dimensional vacua. Well, OK, that just means the Q-sphere is V minus four-dimensional. And I have a Q-form flux where Q is D minus four. The radius is always less than, well, the radius of the sphere is basically set by the higher dimensional cosmological constant. And since my vacuum energy can be 0, I can have an arbitrarily large hierarchy between the vacuum energy and the size of the sphere. So this is not like the standard Freund-Rubin compactifications without lambda, where the size of the sphere is always the value of the lower dimensional cosmological constant. Okay, so it's really a compactification. You can play more games if you add multiple kinds of flux, you can find multiple kinds of solutions, where for fixed dimensionality, you can have lower dimensional vacua with different effective numbers of dimensions. Okay? So this is a landscape, if you allow me to have multiple kinds of flux, which has all possible cosmological constants and all possible dimensions. OK, so this is the vacua. But now we want to find solutions where the size of the sphere gets some dynamics, okay? Has some space-time dependence. So we need to start with an ansatz for the four-dimensional metric. And we're going to pick the easiest one, and the one most relevant for cosmology, which is to assume that it's homogeneous and isotropic. So that means we're going to have a four-dimensional FRW space with the scalar field phi. OK, well, we have some choices. So we can have the curvature be negative zero or positive. And we don't want to pick the positive one, basically because there's no way to analytically continue this and not get time-like curves. So that's bad. And we want to construct these solutions that have event horizons, et cetera. So we'll focus on these two examples. And I said, by analytic continuation, you can turn this FRW space into some space of constant density, which has a space-like norm. OK, so you've seen it. There's the metric. There's the equation. If we're in a region where we assume that the variable tau in the metric, which is the proper time, if that's really a time, if it's time-like, then we evolve our scalar field in the right-side-up potential. And if we assume that tau is space-like, where we've done this analytic continuation, then we evolve phi in the upside down potential, right? That just comes from sticking in these two equations. Tau goes to I tau, just like in the black hole. So you pick up an overall negative sign. OK, so these are cosmologies. And we typically think of cosmologies, FRW cosmologies, as starting with curvature singularity, the Big Bang, or ending in a Big Crunch singularity. So let's ask in this model, when that happens. So we can recast the Ricci scalar in this four-dimensional theory in terms of the scalar field alone. And the Big Bang, or Big Crunch, is where E equals 0. So R is just going to be finite always as A goes to 0, basically when the field energy is finite. When phi dot or V doesn't blow up, then as A goes to 0, this is nothing special. It's just a coordinate singularity. So what do we need to make that happen? Well, if I look at the field equation, then I see that as A goes to 0, I'm getting some divergent term here. So that means that basically phi dot has to go to 0 fast enough as A goes to 0 for this field energy not to blow up. And this is going to be possible to arrange both in the open and flat cases. And the scale factor is going to have a universal behavior near the Big Bang or Big Crunch. So if I have an open FRW ansatz, and I assume that the field energies aren't blowing up, then I have, from the curvature component, a 1 over A squared. So that's always going to dominate as A goes to 0. And therefore, A has to go like tau as tau goes to 0. Whereas if I have a flat metric ansatz, and the field energy isn't blowing up as A goes to 0, I don't have the curvature term anymore. And I know phi dot has to be going to 0. So that means the only thing left in the Friedman equation is the potential. So basically, I have to have a metric which behaves as an exponential as tau, as A goes to 0. Since it's an exponential, tau can now go to minus infinity instead of just to 0. So of course, you've seen this before. This is just what happens in De Sitter space in the two different foliations that I could pick. In the open case, I cover this part of the De Sitter manifold. And A goes like tau as I go to the coordinate singularity there. In the flat foliation, then A goes like e to the ht as I go to tau goes to minus infinity. So the thing that's wrong, why I'm not interested in it, is because I can't. I don't have it on that slide. In a second, I'm going to interpret these coordinate singularities as event horizons, so I can think of analytically continuing across them. in the closed case, that's not really possible. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, so what we're going to do, the name of the game, is basically to construct solutions by specifying a potential. So we fix lambda and q. And then we're going to choose a metric on SOTS, which will be open FRW. And then we're going to pick some points, pick some radius of the spheres, and match segments of time-like and space-like tau across some region where I set additionally a equals 0. So this is going to be a coordinate singularity or an event horizon in the higher dimensional geometry. So I evolve away in the time-like direction, I evolve away in the space-like direction, and then I basically just match these two solutions across that point. Okay, so it turns out that you can do a lot of things exactly in this simple toy model. So at large phi, the dominant term in the potential turns out to be the one proportional to lambda. And this is an exponential potential. So if you've ever studied quintessence or the like, you know that this admits attractor solutions. So no matter where I start, I always end up having the same behavior as phi goes to infinity, or the volume of the sphere goes to infinity. And you can check that the metric actually approaches that of a d-dimensional de Sitter space as phi goes to infinity. Okay. So this part of the geometry, I start at an event horizon where a equals 0, and phi is at some value, and then I evolve to d-dimensional de Sitter states. Okay, now I have to evolve away from that point in the space-like direction. And now we basically do if any of you have ever studied instantons, Coleman and Zaluza do. First, we note that for this potential, if I look at the auxiliary Friedmann equation, the second derivative is negative definite in this region. So that means the scale factor has to be bounded. But if I start from some generic initial condition, the scale factor is bounded, I can set phi dot equals 0 at the first place where a equals 0. But it's non-trivial to find phi dot equals 0 at the second place a goes to 0. So if I start from some generic initial position for phi, then what happens is scale factor comes down towards 0, and phi just ends up rolling off to infinity. Okay. So those solutions are singular. And what you need to do is basically match the time it takes for the scale factor to go between its two zeros to the time it takes the field phi to roll across that barrier and stuff. So for small enough charge, you can indeed find that this is true. There's some nice analytic results you can show that you can find in the paper. But basically, to tell you can find that this is true. You can prove that this is true. So there are two, when you can find such solutions, there are two places where a goes to 0, and that means there's going to be two event horizons in this geometry. So the part we've just described now, I evolve away from this event horizon, and eventually I reach another one. And in this region, tau is constant along these time-like curves. Okay, so now I end up here. And I have to find out what happens. So for small charge, I get a negative minimum. And generically, what happens as I evolve in this negative minimum is that any perturbations that exist get refocused and cause a big crunch. This is the same thing that happens in a negative cosmological constant bubble in internal inflation. Basically, from generic perturbations, you always end up in a big crunch. For a zero or positive minimum, then, nothing special happens. You just start up on this potential. You evolve towards a zero or positive minimum. You're in de Sitter space, right? Nothing can go wrong. So you just evolve to the vacuum. Okay, so in this region, you basically have a four-dimensional Friedmann-Robertson-Walker universe that evolves at late times to a four-dimensional de Sitter space. And sits up there. The sphere is stabilized at some small size. And this could be our universe. Hey, why not? Let's assume that's true and see what the consequences are. Okay. Yeah, so we invented this really annoying notation in the paper where we had p's and q's and all sorts of crap. So read 4. But well, Q is D minus Q is 4. Yeah, correct. Yeah, it depends on what D is, right?
Minimum 2. So you could have 6 dimensions, compact a polyon of 2 sphere, and end up with this 4-dimensional Robertson Walker universe.
Can I?
Yeah.
I'm a little confused by what you mean by the event horizon. I mean, is it, maybe you could explain. So for a black hole, I mean, even as T goes to infinity, you have this event horizon. That's a global event horizon?
Yeah, this is a global event horizon. It's really like a cosmological horizon or a frame horizon, depending on which one. So it's a null surface where the radius of that Q sphere is everywhere constant. So really it is indeed like exactly like you think of a black hole event horizon or a frame horizon.
And so that point over there, the tip, is T going to infinity?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So think of this geometry. This geometry is exactly the same as a Schwarzschild de Sitter black hole, if you're familiar with that. So there, you have a black hole horizon, you have a cosmological horizon. This is the radius of the two sphere going to infinity, this is the radius of the two sphere going to zero. And the analog of this region here in the black hole case is just the region between the event horizons. Okay, so we'll just go through this geometry again and recap all the different pieces and paste it all together. So in the case when I have a negative minimum, there are these three segments. Positive minimum, there are these three segments. And on the Penrose diagrams that I've drawn on the right, they correspond to the following. So region 1, remember, corresponds to going off to d-dimensional de Sitter space. So that's these cases of this Penrose diagrams that I've drawn here in the two cases. Region 2 is this place between the event horizons. And region 3, I either roll off to a big crunch in the case when the minimum is negative, or I roll off to a lower dimensional FRW universe in the case where it's positive. That ends up considered. So again, read for wherever it says P plus 2, sorry. And of course, there are many other solutions that you can generate from other choices of the metric onsets. So for instance, you can make your favorite non-extremal standard black brains by assuming a Bianchi universe instead of a FRW universe. You can make various other sorts of bent brains and interesting geometries by assuming different things about the four-dimensional sections. And you can find all that in the paper. So another kind of neat thing that you can add onto this is to try and embed inflation. And in this case, there's a geometrical reason.
There's a geometrical way of setting the initial conditions for inflation to coincide when the universe became effectively lower dimensional. So the way you can do that is you can add some extra scalar field. We'll call it psi. Of course, we're doing inflation, so you just add an extra scalar field. And then you couple it to either the curvature or the flux, or both. Okay? So in the full d-dimensional picture, I've got this geometry. And depending on where I am in this geometry, the local value of F squared or the local value of Ricci is going to change. So let's say I make f of psi just 1 plus psi squared. Then you can arrange for it to be true by tuning. And of course, we're doing inflation, so you have to tune. That this field psi is stable everywhere except for inside of the event horizon of this brain solution. And so you can open up a tachyonic direction on the event horizon and then end up inflating, which is kind of neat. Okay, so now let's talk about the dynamical part of the compactification. So I've shown you these classical solutions, And in the black hole example I talked about in the beginning, I alluded to the fact that empty de Sitter space is unstable to nucleation of charged black holes. So of course, now I'm going to tell you that empty higher dimensional de Sitter space is unstable to the nucleation of these brain solutions. And there's two different instantons that can be responsible for this. So basically, one, which I'll call this interpolating solution, is take that region where tau was a space-like variable and Euclideanize that part of the solution. So you can construct a Euclidean instanton of finite action by doing that. Another way is to look at a solution where the field just sits on top of the hill while A does its thing and goes between 0 and 0. Euclideanize that solution, and you get a finite action instanton. And for instanton aficionados, I'm not talking about anything more fancy than the Coleman de Lucia or Hawking-Moss-like instanton. Okay, so so these solutions are analogous basically to the instantons that are responsible for nucleating charged black holes out of de Sitter space. So if you've ever read that literature, there are these different lukewarm and cold and all these different kinds of instantons. And that corresponds to solutions that are different in sort of the same way that they are here. Okay. So empty de Sitter space is unstable to these to the nucleation of these objects, and we've answered our original question, which was, well, what if in this neat bifurcation of future infinity into different two-dimensional universes, if that was actually four dimensions, and if they were not black holes, but they just asymptoted to some non-singular four-dimensional universe? So loaded question, and yes, that can help. So here's sort of the cartoon diagrams of the space-time solutions. So you start with empty de Sitter space in d dimensions, and you nucleate this object. You asymptote back to d dimensions in one region, but then you go off to four dimensions in another. For this other solution where you nucleate the field on top of the hill, this is kind of like Hawking-Moss, where you don't really know what you're talking about, and you have to invoke some stochastic picture of what this looks like. But basically, you form this region that's locally sitting on top of the hill here. And God only knows in this case what that means in d-dimensions for where the flux line goes or whatever. But OK, just believe me. I don't know. This is some cartoon of what it might look like. So we start on top, and then eventually you fall down, and you either fall back out to infinity and empty out to d dimensions, or you fall into the four-dimensional vacuum. OK, so you can be quantitative, and you can calculate the rates. So we had this exponential dependence on the action of these Euclidean instantons. And I'm going to parameterize the action as some fraction of the d-dimensional de Sitter action. So S de Sitter is negative. And alpha, you can see, is always less than or equal to 1. So so the boxes here represent data points. This should be a curve, but my computer was not powerful enough to calculate a continuous thing. So these are just actions for different values of the charge, okay, for the interpolating solution and the compactification solution. Okay, and there are a few thresholds. So as I increase Q, you'll recall from the Q is the overall charge. That's right. So as I increase Q, you'll recall from this picture of VFI, I increase Q, and that minimum migrates upwards. So the first threshold is where that minimum goes through 0. And that happens here. So in that blue shaded region, you have a minimum that's larger than 0. And the second threshold happens when these minima sort of almost merge. And in that case, the potential maximum becomes extremely broad. And in that case, it becomes impossible to find these interpolating type solutions. So those just kind of die off. And that happens in this green shaded region, where you can see actually from these two curves, the action of the interpolating and compactification solutions become identical. OK, so well, really simple to get the message here. Look at the absolute value of alpha. It's pretty, you know, small. So that means that these rates are basically suppressed by the d-dimensional de Sitter action. So if you have a very large cosmological constant in d dimensions, this is going to be a really, really slow process. Another thing to note is that, the rate for the interpolating solutions is higher when it exists. This is kind of like Kolmogorov instanton, usually when it exists, is higher probability than the Hawking-Moss. And the rate is highest for small q. This is a monotonic decrease. And so you're more likely to fluctuate the solutions that end up crunching into ADS vacua than you are ones that end up propagating forward into non-singular four-dimensional universes. Out of the ones that do end up propagating, you're much more likely to fluctuate the vacuum with the lowest cosmological constant. Maybe that means something, maybe it doesn't. Yeah, so this is both of them. The boxes are the ones that interpolate under the minimum. Yeah, that's the Kolmogorov-like one, and the thing I call compactification is the one that sits on the top. Well, these solutions are a little bit strange in the sense that they're kind of like a charge anti-charge thing in and of themselves. Basically, yeah. You have these non-compact spatial slices, and then you don't have to worry about this, basically. For exactly that reason that Don just mentioned. Okay, good. So these are the rates that you can calculate. And again, there's some pretty analytic expressions that you can find in the paper that are just too ugly to put up here. I guess they're pretty because you can calculate them exactly, but they're ugly because they're too long to put up.
It wouldn't be possible to create a charge without creating the opposite charge somewhere. Uh-huh. If you want the flux to go all the way to the horizon, that's probably infinite action or something.
Well, it's the same as for the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. So you start in the Sitter space.
Yeah, so I would say the finite spatial slice makes it,
right.
These flux lines have to end somewhere, but they do. And since you have a finite spatial slice, you just nucleate. Well, I guess it's not exactly a pair, though. I mean, what?
Yeah, it's not exactly a pair, but it kind of is, I guess. So if I have the Reissner-Nordström solution vacuum with a cosmological constant. So the full solution, in a sense, kind of has two black holes, right? Basically, because I've got the one over here and the one over here. I think that's the way to interpret it, but I'm not sure. Kind of like a bubble solution has two centers, so it's both a pair and an anti-pair in and of itself. Yeah?
Yeah, I thought a bit about these tunnelings with Fazer, Blanca-Piada, and Gilliard-Schwarzschild. And the picture we have is that what textual nucleates are closed black brains, which are magnetically charged. And the instanton, basically you can think of this instanton as higher dimensional de Sitter, which is a sphere which this with this codimension 2, in the case of, say, S2, wrapped around the big circle kind of this sphere. And this closed black brain nucleates and expands. So that's...
I think that's definitely the correct interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah. Oh, but I mean, their solutions are sort of different because they have an explicit brain. I mean, you guys have explicit brains in your solution.
Well, these black brains have, the exterior is just described by a solution to this theory.
gravity plus electromagnetism. So you don't really put the source brain anywhere.
Okay, so so another thing we can do, since we have this very simple theory and we can compute everything more or less exactly, is compare the rates to vacua with different dimensionality, fixing the total dimensionality of the theory and the value of the cosmological constant. So now the charge can take different ranges depending on what the dimensionality is. So let's just normalize this charge to the charge that it takes to get rid of my four-dimensional minima. So as a function of that ratio, I can plot alpha. And again, from this annoying notation that we've invented, the circles, squares, diamonds, and triangles correspond to creating from an eight-dimensional universe regions with 3, 4, 5, and 6 macroscopic dimensions. And the red dot corresponds to where the value of the vacuum energy in the minimum is 0. So it's kind of neat that you can compute this, but I don't really gain any great insight from it, because you can see that the rate to vacua of different dimensionality is kind of more or less the same. It'd be really neat if this was peaked around 4, but it's not. So there's no large disparity. I don't really know what you should compare. Should I compare for fixed normalized charge? If I were going to construct some kind of measure or something, would I compare to 0 vacuum energy? I don't know. Future work. Okay, but you can go back. So once I end up in this lower dimensional vacua, you can decompactify. So this is the work of Giddings and Giddings and Myers, which, you know, basically everything I've told you is you take the decompactification solution and view it inside out. So this. So decaying back happens via the same instanton. And so the space-time picture is basically replace what was D with 4 and match onto the same type geometry. But an interesting thing to note is that the rate into a vacuum is larger than the rate out, always. Okay? So forming these solutions with lower dimensional regions always has a larger probability than emptying back out. So in a sense, you might take this to mean that the lower dimensional theory is sort of the ground state, right? It's not the other way around, which is kind of a neat interpretation. Well, the minimum has to be above 0. Minkowski vacua are stable. Okay, and propagating this, of course, you end up with a picture that looks exactly like eternal inflation, because you form these regions of diverse properties, solutions with different values of the charge, and therefore different values of the cosmological constant in the lower dimensional regions, different regions of different dimensionality. You can go back and forth between the lower dimensional and the higher dimensional regions, and you basically get some picture that looks like higher dimensional eternal inflation. And of course, connecting this mess to predictions is what we've been talking about this whole time, and there will be more conferences on this, I guarantee. It's a very difficult issue. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to tell you today. We start from this theory. This theory has a landscape of four-dimensional vacua. And you can find these solutions that interpolate between some d-dimensional de Sitter region and some lower dimensional FRW region. And the way you do that is by going across event horizons, just like in the black hole example. You nucleate these things from de Sitter space, so you populate that landscape. And you go back and forth, and you make something that looks like eternal inflation. OK, so I think there's a lot of neat things you can do with this toy model that might have something to say about the real world. So the first thing you can say, you can ask is, what about the stability of these things? So these guys, they studied the stability of the compactification solutions, just a four-dimensional de Sitter across a Q-sphere. And if Q is bigger than 4, you get tachyonic Kaluza-Klein modes. Okay, so there are real instabilities that could be bad. And you have to ask about the endpoint of that instability. And according to these guys, who wrote some interesting papers on this, basically you end up with a solution where the quadrupole on the sphere grows, but it gets a minimum in its effective potential. So this tachyonic direction just takes you to a squashed sphere. And it's still a compact manifold of essentially the same volume. So kind of the stuff that I was saying before ends up going through. Now you can ask about the stability of these interpolating solutions. And that's in progress. It seems like they're stable and they actually don't suffer from the same instability. And then you can ask about the thermodynamic stability. So there's event horizons in this geometry. So what about Hawking radiation? What does that mean for this universe to source a finite Hawking temperature? And that might lead to some interesting parallels with black hole physics and eternal inflation, because you can embed this transition process inside of your black brain. So maybe there's some things to do there. Okay. Another thing is you can study inhomogeneity. So you are going to get collisions between these interpolating solutions. By that, I just mean multi-centered brains. So you're going to nucleate more than one of these out of De Sitter space. There's some probability you nucleate more than one in the same Hubble volume. And that's going to basically lead to collisions between these different solutions. And I think it's even worse, and I think, Ben, you actually mentioned this, Sean, that you have this field outside of the brain, and that's going to stimulate the production of brains outside of the solution. So this is similar to Schwinger pair production in the atmosphere of a Rice-Northam black hole. So it'd be interesting to calculate the rate as a function of charge, for instance. And this is going to change the geometry inside of the brain solution. So it's going to change the geometry of the effectively four-dimensional FRW universe. And perhaps that leads to interesting ways to observationally distinguish this from other scenarios. Another thing is that on the other side of that Big Bang surface, which is just an event horizon, the extra dimensions become larger. In that interpolating region, they don't ever get larger than the size of the higher dimensional cosmological constant. So you can ask if that leads to any interesting effects. Perhaps the fluctuations in the higher dimensional De Sitter space propagate into this brain solution and lead to interesting effects. I don't know. This could be something to look at. And then there's a host of measure issues, of course. We have all these nucleation rates. Maybe you can talk about statistical predictions from this, and you need to figure out the measure problem. And then, of course, you can embed sort of more or less standard four-dimensional eternal inflation into this picture. So inside of that locally four-dimensional region, you can get membrane nucleation, and that's going to change the value of the charge locally inside of the black brain. And that looks a lot like the Brown-Teitelbaum mechanism, where you just are changing the local value of the cosmological constant by changing the local value of the charge. And there might be some subtleties, because you have this dimensionally reduced picture, and the brains are going to interact with the moduli. Here it's simple, it's just a radion. And you can look for other solutions with different symmetries, et cetera, and you can think of a billion things to do. So thanks, and thanks for your time.
So now it goes back to being on time, or we all decided not to be hungry for 15 more minutes.
Does anybody living inside of one of these regions actually see a history of transitions, or they just come up?
So they could possibly see the effects due to these multi-centered solutions. So if there was a collision, say, between these two brain-like solutions, then you could see.
But yeah, the solutions you have.
Well, there you
just like somebody wouldn't include any of these.
Not without colliding with it, basically, because if it's in your test light cone, then you're going to collide with it because you're going to see it. Yeah.
So, I mean,
I mean, you start inflation here, but if you start inflation by a transition down from six dimensions, then there's going to be some kind of cosmology with some unique initial conditions. And if inflation goes on for a finite amount of time, that stuff is there. I mean, it's the usual game with inflation that it tries to...
Yeah. I'm just saying, the fact you've drawn high dimensions here doesn't alter the causal picture.
No, so here we are, right? Here we go efficiently back to d-dimensional Sitter space. The radius of the Q-sphere blows up. And, of course, I have causal access to some portion of that geometry, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that goes on out here, of course, have causal access. So for instance, and I can't draw this, but if you made a multi-centered solution where that part of the light cone intersected where the horizons meet, or whatever this means in this picture, then you can see that.
So it means you have these two horizons, and what's evaporating on both sides evaporating?
Well, yeah, I don't know that evaporation is the right word, but there's a temperature. So there's a temperature associated with the brain horizon, there's a temperature associated with the cosmological horizon. And of course, now you have to deal with all the weirdness of Schwarzschild de Sitter, which is that you have these two horizons at two different temperatures, and you need to figure out if they reach some equilibrium or what happens.
Well, in Schwarzschild de Sitter, they don't.
Right.
Either they become the same temperature or where one of them evaporates.
Right. But it gets kind of weird, right? Because I remember that in the case when you had the magnetically charged black holes in de Sitter space, then the thermodynamics is a little bit different. Because you can adjust the temperature of, basically it is the relative temperatures, but you can end up anti-evaporating a black hole because you can add enough charge that it has a lower temperature than the cosmological horizon.
But do they tend to this? I mean, as I understand, the Schwarzschild de Sitter, if they're close to the same temperature but different, they tend to become unequal. And then whatever the one that has a hotter temperature tends to evaporate away. But in the magnetic case, is there that instability, or does it actually tend to?
I seem to remember that the whether or not the specific heat is positive or negative depends on the value of the charge. But I can't remember exactly. But I think there is some subtlety like that going on.
Any more questions?
Well, so if you're in this model, if you're in one of these 4D vacua and you want to get to another one, and the transition is going to happen, what is the dominant way that happens? Is it just by some sort of brain and some 4D thing, or do you have to go up to six dimensions and then back down to four, or does it depend on parameters?
I think that would certainly depend on the parameters, because you could make the rate sufficiently slow to transition in the effective four-dimensional theory by tuning the tensions and the relative vacuum energies there. That this could be faster.
So there's some tension of some wrapped brain that you can dial.
Right.
And if that tension is small, then you just kind of stay in the 4D theory.
Right. Yeah, you flop around in the 4D theory faster than you'd undergo these transitions back and forth between 4 and D. Right.
Okay, well, that's it for the morning session.